permission or with your agreement, I'd like to suggest that we introduce Mike Bruisedhead, who's been showing us sections from Kainai News, and I think we will break some new ground here if we can identify some parallels, connect that history in the Middle East to the history in North America here. And if we can bring out some discussion, some many-faceted discussion from the folks in this room and the folks in your room. So with your permission, can I introduce Mike Bruisedhead, who is vice principal of the St. Mary's Kainai High School. And this is his wife, Barb Bruisedhead. You have another name there.
Jadis.
Barb Jadis Bruisedhead. Mike introduced me to his wife as his boss, so I guess that puts the power relationship in its proper place. Anyway, it's a real pleasure to be able to introduce you to Mike Bruisedhead, who's been a teacher for me over the years. As I say, he introduced me to Blackfoot Country before I ever came here in Ottawa. And when I arrived here, I would definitely look to Mike for insight, for guidance, for interpretation. And so with that being said, I'll introduce Mike, and maybe we'll go for 20 minutes or so, have a bit of a break, and then see how we can do in finding parallels or contrasts or comparisons between these historical accounts.
Hello, Tony.
Mike.
I guess you're in Mi'kmaq country, so I'm going to say Kwe or Madeleine. And did everybody have their Pideawe or Bedawe? Okay. Okay, Blackfoot, hello here. Tony, just as you were speaking, there are some great deal of similarities in your presentation, and you speak of institutions, and it's unfortunate that our historical institutions have never been brought forefront, that our institutions have been dictated similarity to the group of people you're referring to, and the so-called colonized people, which I don't like, but I guess that's how it tends to happen. These institutions, I guess under the 1700s doctrine of discovery, other countries planted their flags here and sort of fought over who's going to apply their government institutions in this case to the, I guess, First Nations people in Canada. I guess my presentation tonight is kind of a speed dial. In Canada, the first concentrated effort since 1877 when we signed the treaty, Treaty 7 in our area, and I am a direct descendant of Chief Red Crow. That is my grandfather's grandfather, so that's my great-grandfather, and maybe just maybe spiritually, genetically, whatever, sort of taking that passion of studying the indigenous rights of my people. So there was a declaration I was showing the class here, and you spoke of a declaration, and these declarations are not long in length, but they seem to have the whole heart and soul of people, and it's unfortunate that declarations seem to have to come about where, I guess, the existence of a culture or a language or a race is about to be transferred, eliminated, diluted, assimilated, genocidal. It's unfortunate these declarations have to, I guess, come about. And as you read, this declaration was made November 19th, 1991, at the time, the Trudeau-led Liberal government was strongly in favor of eliminating and changing the old British North America Act, Section 9124, which referred to Indians and the lands reserved for them.
Mike, could I just mention that I think you said 1991. You mean 1981.
1981. Right? Sorry about that. 1981. And through the constitutional protocol and process of Canada, the premiers did meet, and our very own premier, which our native reporters did pick up on, also voted against the entrenchment of native rights in the Constitution. It's unfortunate that this happened. A very scary situation, if you want to use that word. And, you know, for the constitutional process to have the endorsement of the change of the Canada or the British North America Act, to have that changed and to have the protection or those, actually only two clauses referring to Indians, to be changed.
Can I just introduce, I did bring it in. So this is the Supreme Law of Canada. It describes itself as the Supreme Law of Canada. This is the act that the Queen signed on Parliament Hill. So ironically, it didn't really break the imperial tie because it's ultimately the British Parliament that gives this legitimacy. And so this is an effort to take, say, the Universal Declaration on Human Rights in the United Nations to articulate what are the rights and freedoms of individuals. There's something called the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, which goes up until Section 34. So you'll notice that everything above Section 34 is called the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms. And I'm sure you hear this referred to. Some of you may have actually looked at the wording. It's a short document, but here is the controversial phrase that all of effort is around, Section 35. So I brought that in, Mike, and I thought I would take advantage of the opportunity of this showing the wording there.
Here's a document that was put together by the Saskatchewan and Alberta First Nations. The constitutional history, the original constitution proposals by Prime Minister Trudeau had no mention of Indian or Aboriginal treaty rights, October 2nd, 1980. And you go right across Aboriginal and treaty rights. Indians were ignored and objected at being left out of the original proposals as a full participants in constitutional discussions. Indians believe that the government wanted to wipe out Indian people, Indian lands, Indian rights. So, Tony, you speak of parallels. You spoke of people being disenfranchised. That almost totally happened in the modern times in so-called Canada here. The proposals, the constitutional changes, the Prime Minister Trudeau government was trying to change over, and they're trying to get the blessing of the British Parliament and the monarchy of England, was a great cause of concern. There were protests here, every major city. I think the elders that were 60, 70, 80 years old, that were kind of in the middle, they were too young to have participated in 1877 and living with this kind of type of regime, the Indian Act, that is the administrative tool to govern First Nation Reserve, and actually witnessing a modern changeover that was very detrimental to our basic existence as First Nation people. The constitutional history, the clause that recognized and affirmed Aboriginal and treaty rights were inserted during the joint Senate Commons constitutional hearings January 30th, 1981. And across from that, the recognition and affirmation clause was a positive psychological and political breakthrough, but it did not go far enough to guarantee the protection of Aboriginal and treaty rights. So even though it recognized and affirmed, it still did not guarantee the protection of Aboriginal and treaty rights. Then it continues, the clause that recognized and affirmed Aboriginal and treaty rights were dropped with the federal provincial accord November 5th, 1981. Now, imagine almost 10 months later, a whole roundabout change that the Liberal government was so, I guess, used the process where the premiers of this country were allowed to participate to change a federal recognized treaty rights that we signed as nation to nationhood to England, to the monarchy. And now we had the premiers who have no say in their provincial, because of the provincial status here in Canada, now participating and attempting to dictate the, existence of our treaty rights, which are way above federal. These are nation to nation, as two countries would sign a treaty. Such as England to France, France to United States. That was the position that has been always been taken since 1877. And now, as I've, and I'll show his picture again, the premiers now being allowed to participate and to abrogate and attempt to change our rights. That was the premier of this province at that time, and he was one of the nine premiers that voted against the entrenchment of native rights. So the old British North America Act was going out the door. The Liberal government found that this transition and the gap that was happening, that they will take this opportunity to erase all those things. I don't know if I could just go back a bit. In 1980, about 10 young Indians ran across on foot to Ottawa over land claims and treaties. And this was in 1980, almost 6 months to a year. And this where I'll kind of not brag about myself, boldly say that I was one of the participants. I was not a politician. I was not an activist. I would like to, deem myself as a peaceful protester over rights that were duly mine, ours, to our people. To wake up this country, a whole bunch of no-name Indians. We weren't leaders. We weren't chiefs. We ran from our reserve here in southern Alberta, all across Trans-Canada Highway, right to Ottawa, running 22 miles. And this picture, we're relaying a sacred bundle that had our original treaty documents in there on our treaties and how it was signed. This medicine pouch never got into a vehicle. It arrived in Ottawa on foot, and we relayed it 1 mile at a time, 3 or 4 runners at a time. And by the time we got to Ottawa, there was 52 runners. When we got into Ottawa, all 648 bands, or First Nations people in Canada, were there to greet us. We shook this country because we saw this thing coming down from the Liberal government. We're mostly educated people. We saw this, and I think some First Nations laid back thinking that it was not possible, that no government can actually change our basic existence in this country, only to be awakened with the media things that happened, that it was about to change. Several court cases. One, a court case, May 4th, 1981, where the Alberta Chiefs, Indian Association Alberta, devised a legal plan to block the patriation of the New Canada Act. This legal battle or court case was to determine constitutionally and internationally where we stood with treaties and the middle body being the federal government, if the federal government of this country even had a say-so to try and attempt and downgrade the treaties as we determine are of international nature and stature. So this came about in May 4th, and I guess tying into Tony, your presentation, this whole aspect, freedom to negotiate. You talk about the Palestine people, the other people that they had to check with. They had to get their historical claims together. We did that whole process too. And I think the lawyers of that time that were hired had a crash course on international law, because there's not too many cases that involved in modern times First Nations treaties and the British Parliament or monarchy. It's not like every day in a courthouse, a Queen's Bench, or in a federal courthouse that there is a case of this nature. So this was also a new era, a new ground for federal constitutional law. This was a learning experience for all people involved. And again, we were not going to go to Lougheed, the premiers, or to Trudeau to, I guess, gather or obtain their consent to ask them, can we please go negotiate in London with the Queen and the British Parliament? Will you allow us to go? We didn't even ask for that, because we still believe that we are our own sovereign people, that we have been here time immemorial, that we have had our inherent rights still passed on, only interfered by these colonized treaty agreements. So that was a case that happened in May 4th, 1981, and one of these strategies that the chiefs worked on. In 1981, here's an actual itinerary that was given to me departing from Calgary, November 28, 1981, 6:10 p.m., from running across Canada on foot and now going to England to, I guess, speak for my ancestors and grandfather. sore throat. On this whole area of change, and so we arrived in London December 5th, 1981. And I was put in the situation, had been elected that November to the Blood Tribal Council, the youngest member in history, barely 22 years old, being fluent in the old Blackfoot language, and supposedly the academic language that I learned from this university, to negotiate a treaty or the principles of a treaty and to have our rights entrenched. I was going through my documents and I arrived upon this thing here. If you could just maybe
pull it back. You gotta use this button here. Yeah.
Okay, I won't pull it back too much. This is a brief report of the itinerary that we followed. Arriving in London, November 28th, the Treaty 7 delegation, 4 blood councillors, 4 elders, the hereditary chief, Jim Shaw, both sides, some members from Pagan, and our little entourage. There was supposed to be 40 of us. It came down to about 12 people. We had briefings as soon as we checked into the motel. Sunday, November 29th, Les Healy, who was a counselor, departed for London about 2 weeks earlier to arrange meetings with consultant groups and those consultant groups to arrange meetings with the House of Lords, the British Parliament, the Canadian Embassy, members of the monarchy, you know, on the whole thing of why we're being eliminated from the New Canada Act. And the briefings were intense moments. I had to interpret every briefing almost word for word from the day we got there to the elders, who were very fluent in Blackfoot, and their ages ranged from, I think, 70 to almost 94 years old. And it continued. We worked with some of the history. I had to explain the Royal Proclamation of 1763, the whole thing of west of the mountains in Quebec. What's their name again?
Cree, the James Bay Cree? Or?
No, the mountain range there. Appalachian Mountains. That west that King George and his predecessors before him recognized. And we were also met with a person by the name of Victor O'Connell, I think, who once taught here. There was some members of from our team to work on the House of Lords, the House of Parliament, and when we can meet with them. The House of Lords took 2 years in the making before we got there, to have an audience. And the parallel, I'll keep referring to that, Tony, this whole freedom to negotiate. A lot of the colonized people do not have that. We broke the ranks there. I don't know if there was any charge or criminal thing that would have been laid upon us by maneuvering outside the parameters of the Canadian government. The whole thing was a learning experience. And we tested the limitations of the federal government of what we were not, supposedly were not advised to do. And I like to bring in spirituality. And Tony, I don't know if you recognize that. It seems that when there's a cause, there's some spiritual significance. We had our Guyana or Blackfoot ceremonies every morning, and you spoke of prophecies. Our elders, way back when the treaties were signed and things deteriorated and were placed on the Indian reserves, one of the prophecies the elders did say, these people that tricked us into these documents will not always have this exclusive right if they think they obtained it in the past. And if I was to say that in Blackfoot, Amukshi Okakstimaksi, Issuchtik, Madakumatistutukiweksa. These government people in the future will not run us backwards. We will not fall down. And the first pipe ceremony the next day, Monday, November 30th, they had a ceremony and they said the monarchy, the British Parliament, are going to listen to us. And this man that they call Prime Minister Trudeau, and these are words of the elders, we will no longer fear him. And that's exactly what happened. Then the meetings began with external development services, different political lobby groups in London, members of the House of Commons, and again, it was no holiday. And then meeting with legal representatives, Clive Linkletter was a professor at the Cambridge University, and he gave us the British Parliament's legal perspective, what they thought of Canada and the Constitution. He filled us in what the attitudes were over in the United Kingdom, in London, at the House of Lords and the monarchy, how they were viewing this whole process. And again, at some point in time, the first 3-4 days, the thought started shifting where the monarchy and the British government started to understand what our plight was, that our Aboriginal rights, treaty rights, cannot be deleted under the new Canada Act or the Charter of Freedoms. So,
can I just intervene briefly? Go ahead. If you think of decolonization to India, say, the powers that are passed from Great Britain to the Indians of India, those are the indigenous people. The citizens of India get increased autonomy. But in Canada, the powers are passed to the provincial governments and the federal government. Indian people have no vote in the constitutional process. So the powers are, it's a very different type of decolonization, a very different, very, very prejudiced against the indigenous peoples. And I think there were some in the House of Lords who understood this very well.
Yeah. It was just a matter of who would be the colonizers now. No longer strictly as, the great white grandmother would say, these are my children. Now, this, the Canadian federal government almost saying that, but at the same time, they didn't want us to be their children. They just wanted to eliminate every rights we had. So that decolonizing process, if you're to study other countries, in 1981 to now, their relationship to their mother countries, how they negotiate things, is like garment to garment here. Even though they entrenched that, we're fighting for the entrenchment of our rights. And once they're in there, I don't know if we were supposed to have negotiated that we want it to be our own, lack of a better term, own Canadian government. Maybe that's what we should have did, that we want our own prime minister, our own president, or whatever form of democracy we're going to. Maybe that's what we should have negotiated. But the constraints did not allow that kind of thinking because it was totally out of the dimension of the federal government. Always been, will always be. They cannot in this country think that there's going to be 624 little countries. Very hard to imagine. Or a country, Treaty 7, its very own country. That would have been the most, I guess, fundamental, total breakaway from colonization. We are almost decolonized, but in that process of being decolonized, we had to fight for our treaties. If we didn't, then we would have no rights today. So which is lesser of the two evils? That is what I had to explain to the elders from the House of Lords representatives, different monarchy officials, to the elders. How will we negotiate our existence? Do we come back and fight that our reserves and treaties may remain protected? And they asked, we thought as old people that the treaties were here. How come this constitutional act, Manukakstiman, is making the treaties lay underneath it? And if you look at it, that is a paradox. That is a question that has yet to be answered. How can a treaty of international stature, status, be placed underneath a constitutional act of Canada? If you look at and study constitutional law, international treaties, it's like NAFTA agreement signed by three countries being placed under a provincial or federal law, yet it's supposedly an international treaty. Those questions, the legal people, the constitutional experts in the future will have to try and resolve it. But in Canada, they make it sound easy. There's protocol and process that involves the provinces change that. So we'll take a little break. But, there's one page here. On Wednesday, December 4th, 5 p.m. We met with Winston B. Churchill. I thought that was, you know, but same name, I guess. A Conservative Party MP, the chiefs and war veterans attended this meeting to stress that Indian people wanted the part of the negotiations in the Constitution. It was also stressed that many of our Indian people have fought in the World Wars under the British Crown. So now we came from this that we also fought in the wars on behalf of the British Crown to save this country for the Queen or the monarchy. Why are we being treated like this? Our blood was spilled overseas in the world conflicts also. Why are we being demoted to having no rights? So I will end there and we'll take a little break and then I will get into the core of my interpretation, translation with the elders that had me sweating for 2 hours. Being put in a position that I've never been placed in an international forum. And I would like to think, and people can question across this country, that the four elders that we had were kind of the main pushers to have those rights guaranteed and put right back in, and getting the Queen's endorsement and the British Parliament to endorse it, then to tell the British or the Liberal government of Canada, we now pass the Charter, the new Constitutional Act, but with these two sections added on, Section 35. I would like to think that we played an instrument part to it. I would not take all the credit, maybe I should, but being humble to the other First Nations, it was a crucial time. And it blows me every time. It blows me away. Like, what the heck was I doing in there? It was no time to review, only to review after it's all over what just happened. It's like having one of you, he's got your four-year degree, you chase to London or Spain or wherever, and you're translating in Spanish to English, English to Spanish or whatever language, and you're trying to take the concept of those words from your own people that the other people you're negotiating or lobbying with understand. I'm not going to say I'm a professional international interpreter or lobbyist, but if I, pardon my language, screwed up, it would have failed. Totally. It would have failed. If I did not translate that into the old Blackfoot, as we call it, to the elders. And their old Blackfoot, word for word, straight across from one year out the other year to all the parties involved. So, Tony, I'm going to break here. I tried to join this some of the parallels of institutions, of what colonized people go through when they're just kind of jumping up and down for their rights. I hope I've made some connections. Tony?